Welcome to Carborough BookBeat, the program that features reviews and interviews devoted to the literary life of Carborough and the Greater Triangle area. Your hosts are Paul Nagy and Audrey Layden. That's me, and Paul's over there, ready to go.
Yep.
Here on the airwaves at 103.5 FM, as well as webcast live, courtesy of iBiblio on www.communityradio.coop. To find out about our schedule of guests and access show podcasts, go to www.carboroughbookbeat.com. A little news up about the Carborough Branch Library. The library is presenting a special story time event for Mardi Gras. Come enjoy stories, prizes, a parade, crafts, and king cake as they celebrate the spirit of the carnival season.
Isn't tomorrow Fat Tuesday?
It's tomorrow. From 6:30 to 7:30 at the Carborough Branch Library. And you can call them at, where's their number, 969-3006 to find out more about that. And they've got a busy week because on Thursday of this week, they have Row, Row, Row Your Boat to Toddler Time. And on Saturday, Ms. Damaris is back with more of their favorite folktales from around the world. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, just something. You have to remember that Row, Row, Row Your Boat Gently Down the Stream is one of the great metaphysical riddles of all time. And it's an
it's
important,
too early
it's
on
an
a Monday morning.
Thing. It's an important poem to remember. Every time you become, if you think you're getting upset, instead of counting to three, you should say, row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. Merrily, 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 merrily. Life is
but a dream. Okay.
Do that three times, and whatever you were mad about will recede into the background.
Well, that's a good thing to try. I'll try it next time I get angry, but I fortunately don't get angry.
Hopefully it won't be me interrupting your...
yes, my announcement's here. Row, row, row your boat. Let me let everybody know that the library is located within McDougal Middle School at 900 Old Fayetteville Road, Chapel Hill. A phone number again is 969-3006, and you can contact them to find out more about what they're doing and what their hours are. Carborough BookBeat greatly appreciates the support of the Regulated Bookshop. This is an independent, locally owned community bookstore located at 720 9th Street in Durham.
Our fierce sponsor.
Mm-hmm. The Regulator brings authors from around the community and around the world to read from and sign copies of their works. Telephone number 919-286-2700, and the website is www.regbook.com, regbook.com, for more information. Our guests are today are going to be on the phone before they actually come to this area.
Yeah, they're going to be here, in another week or two?
No, they're going to be here this week.
Wow.
Charles and Carolyn Todd, co-authors, team, mother and son writing team. I can't talk this morning. It's too cold outside.
Mm-hmm.
Wednesday, February 25th, they'll be at McIntyre's at Farrington Village Center. That's at 2:30 p.m. And that same day in the evening at 7:30, they'll be at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh.
Yep.
They're authors of A Matter of Justice, the 11th book in the Ian Rutledge mystery series. And I'm going to let Paul talk with you a little bit
Let me tell you a little bit about A Matter of Justice. If you like historical mysteries, then this is the book. This is definitely a series you need to know about. Ian Rutledge, that's R-U-T-L-E-D-G-E, Ian Rutledge Mysteries. You can find there's a whole bunch of them, and they're all still in print and paperback, at least. From the blurb on the inside of the front jacket, a turn of the century. In the war taking place far from England, two soldiers chance upon an opportunity that will change their lives forever. To take advantage of it, they will be required to do the unthinkable, and then to put the past behind them. But not all memories are so short. 20 years later, a successful Lundis business was found savagely and bizarrely murdered in a medieval tithe barn on his estate in Somerset. And with that, the beginning, our Ian Rutledge gets called to the scene, and there begins a interesting novel that not only deals with a mystery, but also considers what is the meaning of justice and fairness.
Hello, Carolyn. Charles, lives. Can you hear us?
Yes, indeed.
Okay, Paul, you hear him?
Yeah, you sound a little faint, but maybe we just need to
maybe
turn
up
the thing a little.
Okay.
So happy that you joined us. I've got dozens of questions for you.
Oh, that's what I would like to hear.
But the first thing I think you should do is tell people about what a matter of justice is all about. To get them as excited about this book as I am.
Well, a matter of justice really goes into the question of what is justice and what is retribution and what is revenge. But it's actually a very exciting story as well. It's about a man who commits a horrible, horrific crime, gets away with it, and then later it catches up with him, or does it? And that's what we don't know. He's a man who is not liked very much by the people who live in Somerset, close to his country house. Mm-hmm. He's admired by people in London. And yet someone hated him enough to kill him.
I think what's intriguing is the way he's found. I mean, this is... you've got a story that starts... Well, first of all, it pulls you in right from the beginning.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, by the second page, I didn't want to put it down.
Right. What is this man in this island somewhere plotting, thinking about? What is going on in his head?
Well, the Scilly Isles are off the coast of Cornwall.
Yeah. Well, it's another thing. It makes you want to visit them.
Oh, yes. They're very hard to get to, but very worthwhile if you can go. But he's in isolation. He has almost an island fortress, you might say, as far as interaction with the mainland is concerned.
Right.
And he has something in his family background that has bothered him for 20 years, and he feels that he would like to do something about it. He would like to have a hand in revenge, but he's afraid to do it without drawing himself into the hangman's noose at the same time.
Right. And then you go from there, from this very interesting and intriguing physical setting, as well as what's going through this man's mind, to the discovery of a body hanging from the ceiling of a tithe barn with wings coming out of his back. I mean, this is a teaser to all of our listeners out there.
Yeah.
Believe me, this is an interesting book.
First of all, a tithe barn was generally set up by the local church, and it was a place where they stored donations and
tithes.
And, pardon me?
And tithes.
Tithes to the church. And that's why it has that specific name. And as you know, that's on the cover of A Matter of Justice.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll plead fifth on the angel.
The angel is a very interesting concept because
it is.
A touch of this runs through the book in several other places. And it's an unusual event that makes the mystery all that much more difficult to solve because it's apparent that the man Quarles wasn't killed where he was found.
Right.
And so all the evidence that might have been discovered at the scene of the crime has effectively been destroyed because of this movement of the body.
And then there's the question of why someone would go to all that effort.
Right.
To, you know, kill them somewhere else, bring them there, and then put them in that
but
rig.
That's part of the mystery.
Exactly. And that's what's so good. I would have to say that this is my first Ian Rutledge mystery, but it is definitely not my last.
It's a good place to start.
Oh, right. Well, I have the list.
That's great. We had a friend, Caroline, remember we had a friend that went to England and...
And she found a tithe barn she took a picture of and sent to us because she was so pleased to find another place for this to have happened.
Right.
Well, the other thing that's so intriguing is, besides the book itself, is how you work together to do this. As Charles mentioned, the wings were his contribution.
Yeah, that was one of my issues. You're a mother and son writing team.
Yes, indeed.
And I don't know how unique that is, but that's pretty unusual. And it sounds like you do. You do most of the historical research.
No, actually, we sort of split it up.
You split the historical research up.
One of the important things we work on is making sure that it doesn't... We want you to be able to read the book and not even have a clue that it's written by two people. Or well, that's just clouding the issue.
You're very successful in that.
Okay.
Yes, yeah, you have.
And it truly is a collaboration. You talk about history. I have certain aspects of history that I have a great deal of interest in and have done a lot of research.
Mm-hmm.
Caroline has the same love of history, but some of the things that she finds interesting and intriguing, I've not.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we combine it together, it's like when we go to England to actually go to the places that we write about, Caroline and I will split up. She will go around a town and find things that I would never have looked for, like the grave marker with the statue of the church cat, because the church cat was buried next to the church, and had a neat little story behind that. And I was down in the market talking to one of the bakers about a farmhouse loaf and how it came to being and all this as I was getting my cheddar cheese and bread for lunch.
Yeah.
You know, so whether it's the history or the actual writing where one will write something out, send it to the other, go back and forth till we get it where we want it. It's sort of building the movie of the book.
Right.
And that's why even when we're in the same house, we still work by email.
Mm-hmm.
Because it gives, I can speak for myself, it gives me an opportunity to sit down and quietly consider and read Caroline's thoughts and ideas and have a sense for where she's trying to go and vice versa, rather than just seeing it being typed, having all kinds of interruptions. And
right.
My first reaction is not always my best reaction.
Yeah. Well, actually, so that's actually one of the things I was curious about was how you work collaboratively. Do you plot out your story before you write it, or do you start writing and hope a plot unfolds?
We have never been able to outline. I hate to say that for any teachers struggling to teach their classes to do that. But on that basis, what we do is start with the first theme. Mm-hmm. And if that first theme is what we want, if it is evocative of what's coming later in the book, then we can just move on from scene to scene. There's no outline. We don't know who's going to die sometimes. We don't know who's going to be the villain.
So does that mean you have to go back sometimes and tidy up or throw in some red herrings?
Very little. I mean, we've gotten accustomed enough to that.
You know, well, we better throw a red herring in here. This one is, we're telegraphed this one too easily.
Well, one thing you will have sometimes, you'll get off track. You realize you're putting in a character in a situation where they don't belong. You have to catch up. I think my way of describing it would be being honest to your characters.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. If, as you begin working, you get to know these characters and they are constantly with you, you're always thinking about their interactions and things. And that's what we work so hard on, because this is psychological suspense.
Right, right.
It's Rutledge's ability to understand their minds, no insult, but he doesn't have forensics and all these other things. So it's through an understanding of those relationships that he's able to resolve the crime. And we have to be very careful to be fair and realistic to the characters that we've described,
and also,
and
also
result,
the time.
They don't always do what you want.
Yeah, and also the time. Yeah.
Well, that's what's so intriguing with, and also what is pulling me to read the other books is that the characters are real.
They seem full
characters. I mean, you get the psychology, you get the roundness of this as a person, instead of just a plot device.
Yeah, which one was the first Ian Rutledge book, anyway?
A Test of Wills.
A Test of Wills, huh?
Yes, that was the first one. It came out in 1996.
Uh-huh. Well, that's an incredible. That means you're almost doing, you're doing almost one a year then, huh?
We absolutely.
Yeah.
You guys are busy.
After Wings, it's been every year, and now we just submitted the manuscript for the next Rutledge to HarperCollins, and we have a new series that will not replace Rutledge, but it's an addition to Rutledge.
Mm-hmm.
That
a new character?
Yes.
It's a female nurse.
Mm-hmm.
And her name is Bess Crawford, and the first book in the series is called A Duty to the Dead, and it's coming out in July.
August, they told me.
Late August.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They keep moving it little bit, but they're fine-tuning it. But you've got plenty of time to finish reading Matter of Justice before Duty gives you a little break and then back to the Red Door in January.
This is good. Yeah. Well, how about yourselves being on the road promoting your books? I mean, that must be time-consuming, too.
It's time-consuming and it's tiring, but the benefit is that you get to meet bookstore owners, you get to meet fans and readers. You get to see some of the places where your fans live. We get a lot of email, and sometimes we'll go through a town and say, oh, remember the email from Barbara? I think she lived around here.
Yeah. Well, actually, we want to tell our, you're coming here, going to be here this week, on Wednesday, right?
Oh, yes.
And you're going to be at the
Farrington Village.
Farrington Village.
At 2:30 at the barn at McIntyre's. And then at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh at 7:30 the same night. So that's a heavy schedule.
Well, we're flying in that morning.
Right.
<Yeah. laughs>
We get up at 5 o'clock to make the early morning flight.
Well, be sure to enjoy yourself in terms of relaxing and get to one of the nicer restaurants in the area. We do have a few of those.
Oh, yes, you do.
I live in Winston-Salem, and Caroline was born and raised in North Carolina, so it's more coming home for us.
Mm-hmm.
As long as I can get some Eastern Carolina barbecue.
Yeah.
And sweet tea.
And sweet tea.
Oh, sweet tea. You know, they have sweet tea in Virginia, don't they?
Well, you're in.
We're biased.
But you also go around the country, don't you? I mean, you've got a regular schedule.
One time I did 16 states in 14 days.
Oh, my goodness.
My, oh,
oh my.
My
goodness.
But it is really, Caroline mentioned this, and I do want to stress this. We have met some of the nicest people.
Mm-hmm.
Helpful as far as taking their personal time to come pick you up at the airport and take you where you need to go, or mm-hmm. making sure that you've got something to eat, because mm-hmm. your meal schedule gets pretty well messed up.
Right.
And just nice people in general. And I know you, that's the kind of thing someone in this business would feel obligated to say. But mm-hmm. that was something, when Caroline and I first started this, it was to write a book together. We weren't even really trying to get it published as much as we were interested in the experience of working on it together.
Mm-hmm.
And getting to meet all these people has just been the icing on the cake.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was, I made a previous call to you yesterday and talked to your husband, Carolyn, and it sounds like you've got a third partner back there who doesn't actually do the writing, but is very helpful.
He has been wonderful. I mean, he has driven us through England
mm-hmm.
on mm-hmm. what we consider the wrong side of the road.
Mm-hmm.
He's taken pictures. You know, I'll say to him, or Charles will say to him, can you go back farther and get an overall shot while we do the little details?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He has proofread the books.
Uh-huh.
On occasion, he has done laundry and cooked dinner when we had a tight deadline and he was running out of things to wear.
Now, when Caroline tells John to back up and get an overall picture, he has learned to look behind him first.
I hope so.
But he's a terrific photographer
uh-huh.
as well.
Yeah.
So
mm-hmm.
we have effectively three photographers mm-hmm. trying to capture this place, because we'll spend about 10 days in the area, but you really need to spend a month. And so with three people, multiplying that, when you come home, you have a really good feeling for the villages. And we have liked going into the villages more than London, because London has a set kind of crime
mm-hmm.
Profile, whereas you go into the villages and
gets quirkier.
Yeah, you get people hung from
that's
barns.
Right. And you know, it's interesting, because there's so much more variety, let's call it, of reasons why people who were perfectly respectable,
mm-hmm.
Very nice neighbor and all that, would turn around and kill someone.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of that, I assume, do you have a British edition of your
yes, we have. We've had.
How are they doing there?
Do
you get the Brits coming
well
back to
there.
You and saying, well, this is British enough? Well, I wouldn't say that. They're usually more, more reserved.
We have several British friends that are authors that are very good at what they do and very supportive of our work.
Uh-huh.
Naturally, there is a certain aspect. For example, if you were to write a book about living in Brooklyn, there would be some people in Brooklyn who would say, you don't know Brooklyn, I know Brooklyn.
You got to get that clipped accent just right, you know, get the words in just right.
But that's what one of the other things that was so interesting is the fact that I like mystery novels, and one of my favorites would be Martha Grimes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, as well as, of course, a whole list of others. But you are not natives of England. You go there, and you get all this information and all this research and soak up the atmosphere, and I never would have guessed that this was not an English mystery novel.
Right. Right,
I mean,
that's
it was
true.
Just.
Well, that's a very nice compliment, because this is what we strive for.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to believe in the people,
right,
you have to believe in the setting and the tone of voice and mm-hmm. their outlook. The British have a very different outlook
mm-hmm.
from Americans or Australians. And on that basis, you've got to give your characters a sound footing where they live.
Yeah, and that well, and that's actually one of the nice things about it is that ring of authenticity. I mean, in terms of the detail, the telling detail came through. You know, it's always difficult. You know, when you're reading a novel and suddenly the knight stops and looks at his wristwatch. You know, well, wait a minute. You know, that's an anachronism. You know,
maybe
well,
this is
authenticity can get you in trouble though. When I learned how to hand crank a car, if you have any experience or knowledge of that, if you don't do it right, you'll break your arm. That handle, once the engine engages,
you got to pull it out quick before it hits you, right? Yeah.
And if you don't, that thing will spin at the same RPM as a motor, and just it'll break your arm.
Why were you learning how to hand crank a car?
Because Rutledge must.
Because Rutledge
has. I mean, we haven't done everything that Rutledge has done.
Well, that's good.
But, you know, if you're going to get it right, you have to experience it. We've even tried cooking an English meal. We've tried all sorts of things.
So you're good at trifles,
though.
About
the knight and the wristwatch, you can't have in 1919... a man run out to his 1914 car and fumble for the keys for the ignition and, you know, drive away.
Yeah.
Because that's just not the way it works. And yet, if you don't understand how that crank has to kick back, you're not going to be able to translate it sound authentic.
Right.
While at the same time, I have read some non-published manuscripts for Mystery Writers of America that these people are historians and they're brilliant, but when they turn to fiction, they bog so much down in...
the minutiae? The minutiae of the times?
Yeah, you know,
yes.
The man's got a knife in his hand and he's getting ready to stab this guy. I really don't care who made his suspenders right now.
That's right.
Very good.
Yes.
So that it's not just translating your novel into another country that you have to become familiar with, but another time period.
Yes. And
which
that's
is after
the
First World War.
We have to be very careful that what the characters know in the time frame of the book is what the people living at that time would have known. There have been some wonderful books about the Versailles Treaty and about the war in general, which give you information that has been gleaned since Rutledge's time. And even though it's fascinating, it's not something that you can put into the book. You have to limit yourself. And this, I think one of the secrets is that you have to absorb so much that it comes out naturally rather than, we haven't said anything about this. Let's stop and write a paragraph about this aspect or that aspect of the period.
So what's one of the ways that you do that? Do you read the old newspaper articles in the time period you're dealing with?
Well, there's some of that.
Magazines.
More than anything else is immersing yourself in what you're trying to do, and that's why I was talking about emailing and that kind of thing, because you can't just sit down and whip through something like this. You have to think back to your memories of when you were there and your thoughts about your characters as you are developing the story by just really surrounding your mind. It's not so much that there are some people have certain objects around that they look at or things they go through to refresh their memory. We try to do as much of that before we get too far into the book. We might have to stop and look up something because we'll hit a technical issue or, you know, what was the name of that street that church was on, you know.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
You know, but more than anything else is that immersion into what's at hand.
It makes me think of what they tell you about method acting. That you have to get into and immerse yourself in the time and be part of it.
Yes.
It's like your own psychology, right?
Mm-hmm. We read a lot of firsthand accounts from the war.
Mm-hmm.
One very touching letter we saw actually in Norfolk, Virginia. They have a wonderful memorial overlooking the water where there are what looks like a platform with leaves from a letter blowing across it. But each leaf is actually a quote from a letter written by an American soldier or American nurse during every period from the French and Indian War up to the present.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one very poignant one from World War I. This young man had written to his mother about his experiences in the trenches. And he didn't want her to worry. So he said, "We have grown roses along the barbed wire, and I can sit here as I write to you and smell the roses and see the marigolds." He made it sound beautiful.
Oh, goodness.
Which was lying like crazy.
Yes, because he knew that if she realized how horrific it was in the trenches, she would have no peace.
Right.
And I thought that was such a tender letter to have written home.
Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things that for me is every little town and village you go into, there almost every time there is a World War I monument. And the monuments vary, but what's always interesting to me is the area around that monument is always kept impeccable. Some are circles filled with poppies, some are have different types of flowers and things, but the edging is immaculate. There are no dead blossoms in there. Somebody's gone through, you know, and you can see that the community, even after all these years, has a connection to that time period and what its effect was for the whole country, not just in London. And
well, that was when I was living abroad in England. I lived there for about a year, and that was my sense of the whole thing, is that there was a sense of depth to the culture. I mean, a long sense of history. It might have been my overreading, but the when I was walking down the street, you know, I could see that those were really old houses, and they had long histories, and there were many generations. Now, I'm from the West Coast in San Francisco, and, you know, we only go, you know, the architecture only goes back a few years, you know?
Yes, and this is one of the things that we draw on, because you will stop in a village, and they will say to you, "Well, you'll like this place much better than the one down the road where you were going, because we have houses going back to 1560.
Wow.
Or we have a history involving one of Queen Elizabeth's tours." Or, you know, you never know what they're going to tell you, but the average person has a sense of place.
That's not something that, you find
that is
in this
true.
Country at
that
all.
Is true. There is a very deep sense of place. And also, everything was more particularized. Like, I don't know, of course, it's even worse now. Generic America, you know, where, you know, every McDonald's is like every other McDonald's.
Yes.
But, you know, before we had this homogenization of America, if you go to England, the way I remember, when you went through those villages, they all had a deep roots and an individuality.
Yes.
That's incredible compared to us. I mean, we're developing an individuality, but it's slow in coming. It takes generations to build.
Exactly. This is a new country.
England's been going on for thousands of years, and they're still, I use the major example from Cornwall to East Anglia, because if you think about not only the landscape, but the people and their heritage, it's completely different.
Well, yeah, the one that really got me was they did that DNA search for the bog woman, you know?
Oh, yes.
And they discover her direct relative, you know, like 50 miles away.
Absolutely.
And, I mean, you know, that's staying in place, folks.
it's amazing. And this is why Rutledge has an endless source of future novels.
Yeah,
in 12 books you haven't begun to tap it.
There's another village in England where they did DNA testing on particularly what was called the junk DNA, and they found that in this particular village had survived the plague in a certain way, and the genetic markers for those plague things were still in place with like well over 70% of the population.
Yes, I think that was Secrets of the Dead program. I saw that, and it was remarkable.
Mm-hmm. As I said, I'm quite sure that England is one place, but I'm quite sure there are many, many places around the world where people do have those deep roots, you know?
A lot of times, unfortunately, they're hard to get to in the really interesting places. Mm-hmm. But then again, places in Eastern Europe, at that time you weren't able to just pull up at the local farmhouse and start chatting away.
That's right. Well, yes, I remember talking to an anthropologist once who was someplace in Switzerland, like the French part of Switzerland, where the peasants went back so far that they had incredible folk customs that were very, very little known about.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, you've also got the studies they've done with a particular tribe in Africa that has the DNA going back to Israel.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And tying that as you know, the thought of some people that this is one of the lost tribes of Israel.
Yeah.
And the customs that they still have that might them that way.
Yeah, there was the Ethiopian Jewish group, too.
Yeah.
Had the fight
for. Yeah.
Yeah. It's amazing the things that are hidden in our history that we now have markers for.
And then we get into getting all this as a richness that comes through in writing the novel.
Absolutely.
And also there's the issue of the mystery, and what I liked about it is was the reflections on justice and on what's fair and what can you really expect that comes through in this.
What I liked about it was Hamish.
there is almost a Hamish fan club.
I would think so. I mean, here you have a Scotland Yard inspector who has his own personal ghost. Mm-hmm. Left over from his own experiences and that
a sense of guilt.
A sense of guilt.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's like Caroline said at the beginning, he was a Scotland Yard inspector, went off to war, and was in the business of killing people, and then came back to renew his career. And yet at the same time, the war left its mark on people in a variety of ways, and Rutledge could not come back missing an arm, missing a leg, an eye, and resume his duties with Scotland Yard. But he could have shell shock, and that was a stigma that he had to hide within himself, because if Chief Inspector Bowles found out, or if it was found out by the village or area where he was doing his work, he wouldn't he wouldn't be doing it anymore.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so Hamish is really Rutledge's alter ego, and his means of dealing with the situation, not from the standard therapeutic, you go through these steps in order to get over it, but from a, I need to have this moment of mental work with Hamish just to survive.
Well, it's a functional approach.
Shell shock victim.
Yes, it's a functional approach.
And we've talked to psychologists about the shell shock, and we've talked to victims of shell shock. It's important to get it right, because this isn't something that can be just a convenient plot device that you drop the next time you turn around.
Right. Well, one of the book's description of, I think, is the fourth book, saying Rutledge is a man walking on the edge of insanity.
Yes.
Finding both relief and more madness in his work as a Scotland Yard investigator. And if you've got...
Is this an Agatha Christie with the dark side?
This is just absolutely intriguing. And the amount of research that you must have, or interest that you must have followed to develop this psychological approach and to pull it into all the characters. I mean, it's not just when you talk about the man who's on his little island plotting and planning and trying to conceive a plan. He also is dealing with his own haunted psyche. So you really bring a sound basis of human psychology into all your characters.
Yeah.
This is the pleasure of writing psychological suspense rather than a true mystery. We're not worried about where people were at 2 o'clock in the morning. Did they hear the dog bark?
Right.
It's really what is down deep inside.
And motivations.
And there was one case, for example, in Search the Dark, where Rutledge didn't really want to arrest the murderer. He understood the motivation. He understood what was happening, and he thought it was a great tragedy to have to bring this person to justice. And yet, as an inspector, he had no choice. I mean, a test of wills, for example, is the test of wills between Hamish and Rutledge to see who will occupy his mind. And there is also another test of wills in the book between other characters. But for Rutledge, this was the first case after the war and the defining moment where he had to either accept Hamish and try to learn to live with him or he dropped over the edge.
Right.
Yeah. That's why that book was considered one of the 100 favorite mysteries of the 20th century by the Independent Booksellers Association.
Yeah, you can't get better than that. And you know, the other thing is, I want to say something about the infectious readability of the book of this one, which makes actually, what I do for a living is I read that other kind of fiction, which is mostly nonfiction, and it's the difference between reading, you know, most nonfiction and expository prose and or academic prose, and reading something like A Matter of Justice is so much fun, because this is just, it just flows so easily. I mean, I know you work hard at probably making it flow so well, but it is wonderfully things. What editors? Do you have any editors in your life?
We've had three of them. Finest editors in New York.
Yeah,
because we were discovered by Ruth Cavan at St. Martin.
Yeah,
we moved to Kate Misiak at Random House, and now we're with Carolyn Marino at HarperCollins. And you can't get much better than those.
So they really help in terms of tightening up your.
Well, they are nurturing
and nurturing. Yeah,
we don't have to send them an outline. They understand that if we can show them the first paragraph or the first scene, that
You'll get something
done.
You're on your way.
Yes, and they don't ask any more than that because they know it doesn't exist. So it's useless.
A Matter of Justice is our fourth book with Carolyn Marino and HarperCollins.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
And I will say they have been superb to us and superb to the series.
Well, what is
but the thing that makes those editors stand out to us is they have a long-term view of the series.
Yes.
They have read everything in the series. And so when they do add something, it's usually just a little fine-tune because they know, for example, we never want Hamish to tell Rutledge something that Rutledge wouldn't have already known.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Right.
Otherwise, the whole thing unravels.
Right.
Yeah.
And they have that in-depth understanding of the series and the work that they can see ways to continue that and are a great deal of help from that point of view. And then, you know, once it is complete, they feel strongly enough about it to provide some really good support.
Oh, and the covers they have given us have been fantastic through the years.
Well, Matter of Justice is on the Times bestseller list, is it not?
Yes, it made it to the Times bestseller list. We were so thrilled.
Uh-huh. This is good. Well, it's definitely a page turner. The I guess the what was oh did you in terms of getting your first novel placed? Did you have an agent? Were you agented? That's always trying. I mean, we've talked to a number of authors and getting the. Getting published, finding the agent, finding the commercial house that'll look at your stuff seems to be
very,
very,
very difficult.
It's a one in a million shot, and no, we didn't have an agent.
What we did was
over the transom. Is that what
we sent it to Ruth Cavan, who was known to at that time to be reading books that weren't agented, and we sent it to her not to buy. But we thought, well, we finished this, and we ought to have some opinion as to whether we are off the mark or whether we have really begun to understand what we're doing.
Now, well, by the way, was that an Ian Rutledge book?
Yes, that was The Test of Wills.
The first one, okay.
And we sent that to her and didn't hear anything for 3 months. And then the telephone rang one day, and the voice at the other end said, "This is Ruth Cavan. Could I speak to Charles Todd, please?" And I was so flabbergasted, I said, "I'm sorry, he's not here." And I called Charles, and I said, "I think I've blown it, Charles. Please call Ruth Cavan and see what it is she wants." And she wanted to buy the book.
Mm-hmm. Wow, wow.
The other interesting thing about that was we had a lot of fun writing Test of Wills, and when we finished it, we started on A Wings of Fire, which is the next book in the series, obviously.
Right.
And when Test of Wills came out and received so much notoriety, the next thing I knew, Ruth Cavan was on the phone wanting a 3-book contract. Number one.
Yeah.
Number two, she wanted the next manuscript yesterday.
Right, right. So, yeah, she knew that you had that way of writing that draws your readers in.
How does that change?
Fortunately, we had one because I can't imagine if we had known what kind of response we were going to get to Test Wells. Before we started on Wings of Fire, it would have been under a great deal more pressure.
A little intimidating.
That's what I was going to ask, is how that might change your attitude towards writing if you know now that you've set up expectations out there.
Well, you tend not to.
Right.
For example, A Matter of Justice got a starred review in Publishers Weekly.
Mm-hmm.
And so did the last 5 books that we've had published. Uh-huh. We've had other...
And Marilyn Stasio.
That usually means it's going to be a bestseller.
Our last five books have all been star reviews in Publishers Weekly.
Mm-hmm.
You want to break the trend? You have to be careful not to let that kind of stuff get into your mind and go back to doing it because you enjoy it and because both of us have developed a fondness for
Is that the purpose of going off with the nurse now?
Yeah, that's just what I was going to ask.
She's not really a nurse except in the first book. She becomes a nurse because her father was a colonel, regimental colonel, and therefore she feels that she must do her part.
Those were the only careers open to women of these days.
Absolutely.
School teaching is in nursing, right?
She could have driven a lorry, or she could have planted a victory garden, but it was not something that she wanted to do. She wanted to represent the son that her father and mother had never had.
Mm-hmm.
But this also gives her a certain background, as does the fact that she was raised in India rather than in England. So she's not as straight-laced Victorian. I don't mean that she's not a proper young lady, but that she has enough of a taste of the world that she has a broader outlook.
Sort of proto-flapper, huh?
Well,
no, not quite.
Did you go to India to find out about her background?
It's more she has a car that she drives too fast that her mother doesn't particularly care for.
Mm-hmm.
She loves athletics and sports. You know, she's a feminine character, but she is part of the new
British woman
in the dead end of the Victorian period.
Yeah.
And that was really exciting, something I look forward to. When we did The Murder Stone, which is the standalone we did that is not a Rutledge book, we discussed what had happened to our female protagonist in that book, because this was going on all over England. All the men and boys were dying, and all of a sudden women were having to handle the family business and the finances.
That's true.
The banks and the lawyers and they'd never been exposed to before.
Did you say that this new novel is coming out in August?
Late August, yes. I think it's
August, September probably, yeah. So that
and the title? 25th.
The title would be?
A Duty to the Dead. She's not a sleuth. She's not a detective. In this particular book, she feels a moral obligation, and that drags her into things that she, when she made a promise to a dying man, never expected to face.
Mm-hmm.
But the moral obligation there leads her to have to deal with this. And because she's a military brat in her own time, she knows weapons. She knows a lot more things than the well-brought-up young lady wouldn't have been exposed to. I mean, she's lived on the Northwest frontier. She's lived in Delhi. She's lived in other postings of her father, South Africa.
This
doesn't mean the end of Ian Rutledge.
Oh, heaven
no, 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 absolutely not. Duty to the Dead comes out, as we said, in August.
Uh-huh.
We have already sent in the manuscript for The Red Door, which will be the next Ian Rutledge that will be coming out December, January.
Wow.
So maybe we'll have an opportunity to talk to you again. One of the things we always ask, Archer usually gets to this question.
Yeah, but I don't know if we're going to have time for it today.
Let's ask them anyway, which is we always ask for books that you have read that you feel are really, really significant to you that you'd like to share with our audience. These would
books
be
that we enjoy?
Authors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lee Child's Reacher series, Val McDermid, Julia Spencer Fleming, mm-hmm. Nelson DeMille. These are all books that we, when we are not writing, or enjoy reading.
Enjoy reading. Okay.
That was great. That was
quick. Nonfiction. I will mention Churchill stuff. I have all of them.
Oh, yeah.
I've read them all. With your interest in nonfiction, I'm sure.
His prose is incredible, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, I want to say thank you so much
for
talking with
this.
Us today. It's been great.
Yes.
And I hope we can do it again.
Yes, and maybe next time we'll have you in the studio.
Oh, we would love that.
We'd let you get a chance to see Carborough.
If you can get free and come see us when we're there.
Uh-huh. Okay. Okay.
All right.
So thank you again, and we'll be in touch for information about Duty to the Dead.
Well, thank you so much.
Okay.
We've enjoyed it.
Ah, so have we.
Yes,
thank you.
Thanks again. And remember, folks, we've been talking about Charles Todd and A Matter
Bye-bye.
Of Justice. So,
that was a great, great conversation. I really do.
We learned a lot, and it was really pleasant to have.
And I'm so glad they're writing another Ian Rutledge book, and we've got
we got heads up on
something
it.
Else. Yes.
We're
doing great guns.
Yeah. So you know, it's one of the things is that you know, as far as genre fiction goes, suspense, psychological suspense, mystery novels are in some ways some of the best writing that's out there, and in terms of leisure and for entertainment.
Absolutely.
I wished I had more time to read it myself, but when I read so much of other stuff, if you look at my Facebook, you'll see I usually give an accounting of what I'm reviewing, and you can mm-hmm. see what types of things that I look at on a regular basis. Okay. big and obscure. Yeah.
This is WCOM LP Chapel Hill and Carborough, and we're at 103.5 FM webcast live, and Carborough Bookbeat is signing off.
Yes, and next week
we have the vegan cookbook.
Oh, vegan cooking. We're going to
Now when I say vegan, you say vegan. When I said vegan, you said vegan.
No. Vegan is the correct term. I was whatever.
Well, this will be a cookbook, a vegan cookbook.
A vegan book
cookbook. With recipes from national, international, award-winning chefs. So if you think that food without any dairy products or meat in it cannot be appealing, you are going to be awakened. There's some beautiful stuff going on. It's a beautiful book. So listen up next week and stay tuned for Tobin Logan and
Alrighty.
Readings.
Take care.
Till then.